Welcome to the Bonus Years podcast, where real people share real stories, providing hope and community. I'm Brooke, and I'm your host. Let's get started. Well, I have a special guest with me today on the Bonus Years podcast. It's my friend Jenny. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Brooke. How are you?
Thank you so much for joining me for this conversation today.
Of course. My pleasure. I think it's well overdue.
I would say so. I was trying to think on our timeline of how we've connected, and it was through Instagram. Mm-hmm. But I think it's been a couple of years.
It has, and it's quite the journey.
Yeah, and we finally got to meet in real life at the Transplant Games this summer, which was like the coolest. I love meeting my transplant friends face to face, and
feeling like we've known each other in person for years.
I know.
It's overwhelming almost, but you feel like you're forever friends because you have that common thread.
It's so true. And so I want to talk about so many things with you, but I think the primary reason we wanted to talk is to talk about your transplant story and kind of where you are now and what you're involved in. Because I just look at you and think, man, she's so inspirational. And I know a lot of us hate being the inspiration word. Like, it's almost like a curse word. But you inspire me because I feel like you're pursuing your dreams and doing the things you love doing. And you just went on this really cool trip that I want to hear all about. So why don't we just go all the way back to baby Jenny?
Sure.
Let's start there.
Well, I mean, that's so nice of you to say, and I could say the exact same thing about you. So whenever I hear that word, I'm just out there just simply moving forward. And I think that's the beauty of the gift that we have is we have the option to do that. But to start my story, I was born in 1988, and I was my mom's first child. And several weeks after being born, she noticed that I was turning yellow. So I was born with biliary atresia. I was born a healthy baby, but over time, the bile ducts backed up and my native liver was destroyed. And at 8 months old, I needed a life-saving transplant in 1989 or I would have died. I received my gift of life on February 15th, 1989 in the city of San Francisco, where I live today. And I sometimes drive by the hospital where my life was saved. It's no longer a transplant hospital. And it was sold to a different hospital. So the center where my procedure was performed is no longer actually the hospital. It was called Presbyterian Hospital, which was purchased by CPMC. But my transplant surgeon went on to start the abdominal transplant division at Stanford University, where I'm or hospital where I'm currently followed. And his name is Dr. Carlos Orlando Esquivel. And he is an amazing person, an amazing surgeon, amazing man. And he saved my life because he was one of the pioneers for transplantation 34 years ago. He was trained by Dr. Starzl, the history of his life and his work is the reason why we're here today. So I actually have a book called The Puzzle People on my mantle of my fireplace, and it's signed by Dr. Esquivel. So I can always kind of remember like the story that kind of led him to become a transplant surgeon and why he was trained. And he actually told my surgeon, go out there, Carlos, and save the babies. And that's exactly what he did. So,
and now you're all grown up.
Yeah, you know, that's a funny thing to say because I still feel like that 17-year-old boy crazy teenager. And now I'm a 34-year-old woman with a full-on career. But so I had the surgery and it was a success. And I did not have very many complications. My course was pretty easy. Growing up, you know, I didn't know I was different because I had the scar across my belly. But my mom, I have a brother and a sister who are younger, and she kind of, treated me the same, except I took medication, got blood draws, and, you know, when I had an earache, it was, you know, for her an emergency. I went to kindergarten, middle school, and high school. In high school, I had a job, paid my way through college. And I mean, I just kind of lived what I would call a pretty much normal life, not knowing everything that I had gone through to be so what in my world was, you know, my version of healthy. And I say that because a lot of young kids don't have that experience of going to do lab work.
Right.
And I did have more ear infections, more sore throats, more coughs than other children in my class, but it was my normal, right? So I'll kind of pause there to see if you have any questions. I mean, it's kind of a wild thing to hear. Was transplanted in 1989 and kind of had a normal childhood, but that's my story. And for years and years and years, I felt very guilty about that because I never really identified with being ill or chronically ill until when I turned 30, I had my first complication. And that's what really led me to jump into where I'm at now with connecting with the community and hopefully like a life work of advocacy and dedication to sharing, you know, why organ donation is so important.
Oh man. I love the conversation around hearing about transplant that happened in the 80s because I'm an 80s kid too. And our stories are very different, but I think the part that always blows my mind is that all this happened before you even could have memory of your life being saved.
No, I did not even have a memory of having, being in the hospital or having an IV. The first IV that I maybe had was when I was 16 years old and had shoulder surgery.
Wow.
Yeah. Like yeah. It had nothing to do with my liver until I turned, again, like I said, 30 years old. And, I had a complication. We'll talk about that soon, but
yeah.
So I had no hospitalizations. I mean, I took medication, but my liver just, I mean, not my liver, the liver that I was gifted just became part of me.
Yeah. I'm never able to put words to it when I hear another person's like whole story, because we're all so different, but like you said earlier, we do feel so connected just because of transplant. And Dr. Starzl was the founding father, if you will, of transplant in the United States and globally, right? I don't know his whole history.
Yeah.
Like I read about it, but I don't know the whole thing. So
I believe it was globally because he would have people from all over the world come and seek his care. And I mean, he was relentless in finding a way to make this happen. So,
yeah. And I mm-hmm. love that you are now living in the city where you were transplanted. Where were you born? Were you in that same area?
An hour from here. So I have memories as a young girl going to clinic in the city or driving through the city. And I always thought I wanted to live and work here. So I've been in San Francisco for 10, it'll be 10 years this year. So this November, which is pretty wild.
Yeah. Kind of a full circle kind of moment. Uh-huh. So as a kiddo, you know, you said you got sick a little bit more than everyone else, but because that was your life, you didn't really notice anything different. What was taking medication like as a kid?
Well, it was before school and after school, so I didn't have any afternoon medication. So, you know, it was just part of my routine. I remember it sitting out on the bookshelf and I would take it. So this was before Prograf. So I took cyclosporine and it, you know, smelled like skunk. Still does.
I didn't have to experience that. So.
Yeah, definitely does. I mean, and when I was on more medication as a younger girl, like 5 years old, 6 years old, you know, I did look a little different and the cyclosporine does cause certain side effects, but, I think it was before, you know, a lot of kids really knew, right. Yeah. That, so it was like five and 6 years old. So, it's pretty wild to think about and like connecting with the community. I've just, the one thing that's so important is everybody's story is so different.
Yeah.
You know, just because I had a complication when I was 30 doesn't mean X, Y, or Z.
Right.
Just you're along for the ride.
And you just don't know when the bumps will be.
No.
Because they are inevitable. I think that's just part of being human and being alive. We're going to have ups and downs, and we don't know when they're going to be, but the gift is that we're living it and we're here for it, you know?
Yeah.
So you took meds, you did normal kid life. Do you remember having like a conversation with your parents at any point, like wanting more information about your transplant?
No, my mom was, it was very, very hard for her to talk about, almost traumatic. It's mm-hmm. kind of like if she didn't talk about it, it didn't exist. Mm. She told my kindergarten class about it, and she was sobbing. So at that point, like I kind of learned this isn't something that we talk about, because she would just get so upset, and you know, rightfully so. I mean, her daughter was dying,
right?
And she remembers what that was like. I don't. So still to this day, we don't talk about it as much.
Yeah. And I think that's an interesting perspective to have too, because there's so much trauma involved in being a caregiver. I got sick at 20 and I'd already been living on my own. And then it's like my parents stepped immediately back into that protective parent role and have a different set of trauma than I have from getting suddenly ill. And it does make for interesting and difficult conversation if we choose to have those.
Yeah. And even when I got sick as a 30-year-old, and when I had my course with my biliary drain, I had it for 8 months and my mom didn't find out until month 7. And that was on accident because I accidentally let it slip because I just didn't want her to have to re-confront that trauma or that wound.
Yeah.
And that was hard. You know, I hid a biliary drain under my dress on Thanksgiving. And I was just released from the hospital the day before. I was draining bile and she had no idea. So,
yeah.
Because for me, having her confront that would be more difficult than the physical pain I was in.
Yeah.
So.
The relational dynamics of transplant are also very unique, I think.
Absolutely. Really have pushed really hard in my life, I think, to prove to people that I am independent on different levels. I think for my own ego purposes, because I didn't want to identify as what I thought as X. But I've actually in recent years tried to start to embrace that, because number one, there's nothing wrong with having a chronic illness.
Yep.
There's nothing wrong with needing help. And there's nothing wrong with things being a spectrum. And for years and years and years, I would push myself to this level of doing, and it just simply wasn't sustainable or healthy. And I realized that the reason why I was doing that is because I was trying to run away from the fact that this was or is my life, right? I will mm-hmm. never be able to run away from the fact that this is something that happened to me. It's not fair, but it's my circumstance, you know?
Right.
Yeah. Biliary atresia is the number one leading cause for liver failure in infants. And it's a rare disease.
Yes, it
they
is.
Don't know what causes it. And, you know, I'm hopeful for the future, but, you know, I didn't even know what biliary atresia was until I was 19 years old. And I Googled it in my college dormitory and I opened it. I read a couple sentences and I closed that browser.
What made you close it? Was it like, I shouldn't know this or like, I can't handle this?
I think a little bit of both for sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because if you weren't talking about it growing up and then you're finally like, okay, I kind of am curious here and you know, you're typing away, it can be like shocking or traumatic in its own right.
Even at 30, when I tried to look up hashtag biliary atresia, I misspelled it. I thought I was the only person in the world, like, except for a couple other people that misspelled it, that simply like was living with it.
Wow. And just because of the way I'm connected in transplant now, I'm like, oh, there are so many living with biliary atresia. And you are really involved in the biliary atresia community. And I do want to hear more about that, but I would love for you to share kind of how things shifted when you had your first big complication.
Oh gosh, 30-year-old me. So it's actually really interesting. So when I was 29, turning 30, I was in Vegas. And I remember that night before turning 30 years old, having this deep feeling of panic, like laying on the bathroom floor, like something wrong is going to happen this year. I should have been overjoyed. I'm turning 30 years old, but I just had this, just this deep feeling of just like, almost like a very deep panic attack, just something telling me that something was going to happen. I didn't know what it was going to be. I woke up the next day and enjoyed my birthday. But it was a moment that really stuck with me, kind of a dark night. And a month before I turned 31, I was in San Diego on a trip with my best friend to celebrate her 30th birthday. And I experienced a couple of concerning symptoms. I was turning, I had some yellowing of the eyes. My urine had become kind of dark. And I had vomited once. So I was like, huh, but it wasn't like to the extreme. So I thought, well, maybe something's odd. I don't know. And I, had a dream. I went to sleep. I had walked 6 miles that day. So I felt fine. I was going along my normal course of my day. I went to sleep and that night I had a nightmare that told me that I was blocked. Like something was blocked. And that morning I woke up and had, a bowel movement and it was white. And it scared the you know what out of me. So I booked a ticket home. My boyfriend at the time picked me up from the airport. He looked at me in the eyes. He's like, not to scare you, but you're jaundiced. I said, okay, take me to the emergency room. So they take me to the emergency room. I walk in just all self, you know, really sure of myself. I'm like, I'm just here for blood work. I'm sure I'm fine. Nothing's wrong. You know, I'm walking in. I wouldn't even let them put an IV in because I'm like, I'm fine. You know, I'm just, something's off. And the blood work comes back and it was not good. Like my alkaphos was 1,000. My GGT was 500. Like it was a disaster. But I kept on telling them, like, look, I don't have rejection. I don't have this. You know, I mean, I'm just like giving them the book, you know, and like, there's nothing wrong with me. I worked, you know, 50 hours last week. I just walked 6 miles. I weigh this amount. Da, da, da. If I had liver failure, I wouldn't be looking like this or talking like this. And I mean, which part is true?
Yeah.
How, you know, in the sense of like, you know, I hadn't lost a lot of weight and, you know, all the symptoms, right?
Mm-hmm.
But also like kind of out of bounds. but I was right. So, so they did a biopsy and this was my first one in my life since I was a kid. He walks in, I have good and bad news. And he tells me, well, you're not in a rejection. And I go, I told you so. You know, I just start popping off because you know, I knew. They're like, but you do have a blockage of the common bile duct. That explains why I was turning yellow, things like that.
Yeah.
So, they tried to fix it and everything that could go wrong went wrong. but my liver was working. So, they tried to do an ERCP to stent it. They couldn't get up there because of my anatomy. They put in a bile drain. That bile drain caused a liver abscess. I had a reconstructive surgery. I had a bile leak. I had, you know, very complicated post-operative course. Long story short, they fixed it. but it was, you know, 100 days worth of biliary drains and all sorts of stuff. And, you know, essentially what they did was reconstruct my biliary system. They haven't really figured out why that happened, but it was just something that, as we know, it happens, right? Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate in the fact that, like, they were able to fix it. I'm very, very thankful for that. But that experience of never having to be in the hospital, never being ill, never having to deal with the workflow is like what I like to call it, because oftentimes I do feel like being chronically ill or having something you have to manage, whether it's allergies or a transplant. It's all about workflow.
Yep.
I mean, you really understand, like, okay, well, to schedule this, I have to do this. This is where I can push. This is where I use my political capital. This is how I manage doing all these different things. I mean, it was drinking from a fire hose, and then having to confront this fact that I was a liver transplant patient for the first time in my life and meeting the person who saved my life 30 years ago, because he was the person who performed that biliary reconstruction. So it was a lot. And then after that, I'm just like, you know what? This is the only way for me to handle the anxiety of going through this is to really confront it. And that is why I started that Instagram page and start sharing my story, because the guilt that I was living with was for surviving so many years was so, so tremendous. Mm. And that page had really become a safe place for me to share my story and connect with people.
Yeah.
So it was pretty wild.
I mean, that really is, like, hearing you say, I was a liver patient for the first time, even though you had a transplant as a baby. Like, I'm still kind of wrapping my head around that, because I don't ever think of the journey being like, oh, I had this thing happen, and then 30 years later was my first complication. You know, what did that, I mean, you mentioned the word anxiety, which I'm always talking about how our mental health is affected by our physical health. Like, how did it change the way you approach your life now?
Oh, so many different things. that's a great question. I think at the core, I'm the same in terms of, but my personality, for example,
yeah.
You know, I'm the same in terms of my level of extroversion and the things I kind of do on a daily basis. I mean, that has really remained the same. I've always been very spirited in, you know, life, and always really wanting to, like, experience things. And, you know, not until later in my life, in my late 30s, have I been able to do that a little bit more with, like, traveling and things like that, which I'm very fortunate. You know, in my early 20s, I couldn't do that. And of course, you know, as a young girl, my family and I didn't travel. Mm-hmm. But I would say my priorities changed, mm-hmm. which is a big lifestyle shift. You know, I started really putting my health first. You know, and what does that mean? Well, sometimes I can't do everything. And that was really a big shift for me, you know, wanting not going out and partying was another thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, my sobriety is very, very important to me. And I work in an industry that's, like, heavily focused on alcohol and networking and, so just, you know, completely abstaining. You know, my priorities have shifted, you know, staying hydrated, going to sleep early, having, you know, friendships that enhance my life, having relationships that feed me and make me want to be better. Right. And so, that's kind of what's changed the most.
Yeah.
But I would say at my core, like, my personality is the same.
Yeah.
But I'm more focused on things that I would hope, like, would help me live the legacy that I want to live. And, you know, that's every day is just a little step towards that. You know, I try to leave with kindness and compassion, but I think, like, some of the things that I've gone through later in life has help me become a kinder and more compassionate person. I don't think at 29, before I experienced all the trauma of being in that workflow, I really, really understood, like, at a core, like, how precious life is. And of course I knew it, right? So, because I had almost lost it, but I was 8 months old.
Right.
So.
You knew it, but you didn't know it.
But with the same thing, I've also learned to be very, very kind to myself and know that I'm an imperfect person. And just because you've experienced something hard doesn't mean that you're automatically, you know, held to a certain standard. right?
Right.
So I'm going to have hard days. I'm going to have days where I'm not kind or not patient. But I think at a core, like some of the things that I've gone through have softened me a bit.
I love that.
Yeah.
So when you say you've learned to be kinder to yourself, this is a question I love when people say this. So I'm just going to, like, what does that mean for you? Like on a typical day, like if it's like, how do you show kindness to yourself?
Yeah. So like, for example, today I wanted to get up at 5:30 and I didn't. I got up at 6:30 and I had to rush, but I told myself, today's today and tomorrow you can try to get up earlier. I didn't hit my workout today, but that's okay. Tomorrow I may do that. But today I just did not have the capacity. I had some competing commitments and I just couldn't show up for all the places of my life. Sometimes I feel that I don't have the energy to call like all my friends and family in a day. But I know that I can try to call them tomorrow. Right. Mm-hmm. So before I would just really push myself. And right now, like my number one priority is my peace. Or even just on my Instagram account, like I haven't been able to be as present or post as much because I have a thumb injury. But stepping back from that, it's hard because like I do like sharing. And there's that anxiety of, am I meeting all my commitments? But the reality is like if you can't show up for yourself, you can't show up for anybody else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I love hearing you say like that you're learning to be kind and patient and gracious to yourself because at the end of the day, like you're the only one who's with you, you're with you for life and like you're too important to give everything away and have nothing left for you at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think that some of the reoccurrences and disease that I've gone through have been because like I didn't put myself first and I didn't listen to certain things. And, I wasn't really honoring like what I knew at the core. Mm-hmm. So allowing the space to listen to that is really important.
Yeah. So, that's really, really good.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, because you always posted about it being called Drain Town, which I love.
Yeah.
Oh, Drain Town.
That was a good one, too. And but, I feel like if you laugh, you cry.
Right? Like there would be so much crying.
Yeah, so much. Laugh.
Yeah. I love that everybody's kind of got like either a nickname for their organ or like whatever situation they've been through. And I think I'm going to start like a list on my website of just everybody's nicknames Drain Town is not somewhere we're wanting to go back to.
No,
for sure.
Stay as far away from that as possible.
Well, and you just went on this like global travel adventure of my dreams.
It was great. Yeah. So
tell me what prompted that and where all you went and what you did.
Well, heartbreak, as every good story.
Every good story starts with heartbreak.
Well, after getting that drain out, so just to backtrack, I had a reoccurrence in my my issue because I was battling some undiagnosed acute cholangitis during the pandemic that didn't meet the clinical presentation. So every time I got labs done, they looked great. And every quarter they looked, great, amazing. And in the sense of like stability, ALTs and ASTs were in the 30s. And, that was my stability, but I knew that something was wrong. And I was sick on and off every 4 to 6 weeks, like clockwork, and very sick, but it would only happen for, 6 to 8 hours. And I'd be on the bathroom floor crying, begging to go to the ER. But it was during the pandemic and never made it because I was more afraid to go there than be on my bathroom floor. So I laugh because that's all you can do. So over the course of having these reoccurrences for 2 years of this, it was a night sweat with pain and vomiting and sweating and tachycardia, but it would be fine the next day. And I was just told it's just, something because everything else was fine. I developed strictures. And so I had to have drains every month. I think I had like 10 procedures where I went to through and they dilated the ducts. So in March of last year, they pulled the tube out and hell, I didn't know what was going to happen. All I knew is that I had to change my whole life because I wasn't listening to myself. And I knew that like, that was just my moment to change my life. So I packed all my stuff up and I moved out and I have this beautiful little bachelorette pad. And I was really able to honor listening to my body, and I haven't had any reoccurrences with my illness because now I know what to look for, and we found something that works for me. So, you know, what was stability at AST and ALT of 30, now my labs are in the teens, which is but this is right now, like that could always change.
Right.
So with all this newfound stability and entering like this phase of my life where I just don't care, I'm going to have a lot of fun. I went on a trip to Singapore, Vietnam, and Bali with my friend who she was in a different stage of her life. She was getting a divorce. So we just had a girls trip. And I was scared because I was so afraid of having disease reoccurrence across the other side of the country.
Mm-hmm.
World. Anywhere before. Ever. It never gone anywhere. And so, and you know, my friend's mom, she's so funny. She was like, honey, which is my friend's name. You know, I'm worried because you're going, halfway around the world with your friend who's like, has an illness or is chronically ill. And my friend was like, no, mom, you don't understand. Like Jenny's like, you know, super wild. Like just goes, you know, and the trip is great. And I did it exactly what I could do. I had a conversation with my doctor. We had a contingency plan. I brought emergency antibiotics that I ended up taking because everyone did get some type of gastric problem, and
yeah.
I had medicine and I was able to avoid all of that. And I had the trip of a lifetime and I was scared, but I think that going through 8 months of going to interventional radiology and having a tube stuck in my side while being awake was way scarier than hopping on an airplane for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And starting my life over and adopting a dog and, you know, just doing whatever I want. And I haven't been in this place of living my truth for a very, very long time. So it was the best thing I could have done. And I don't think that like, if I had gone through all of that, if I could have done it with confidence and also like, I just don't care. What will happen will happen. So,
yeah. I mean, I think this is where I'm like so inspired because it's so easy to say, I have a chronic illness and I'm going to, you know, live my life the best I can, but we don't take any risks. We don't have adventures. We don't like the way that you're smiling right now. When you talk about just going for it, like you had a blast.
I have the very best of a blast, and I've been having so much fun ever since that tube has come out.
Yeah.
So
that's what I want for chronically ill people. Like that's what I want when I have conversations. I want people to go, oh, like look at the excitement, look at the joy, look at the like. And I can say calculated risk. Like it's not like you were just like, I'm taking off tomorrow. You know, you talked to your team, you made plans. But you didn't let fear stop you from doing the thing that you wanted to do. And that's what being brave is. It's not being not afraid, because I don't know there's ever a moment where we're not going to be afraid, but it's like going for it anyway. Yeah. And I'm just like, yes, Jenny, go do the thing.
It was so much fun. It was, yeah. So I'm kind of slowing down from that phase though. I'm just like, I'm going to do everything and anything. And, you know, I'm trying to focus more on slowing down in a good way, like reading more and having more, you know, conversations with friends and being there more for my family and just finding other things that feed me. But definitely like all of those last 8 months were really making up for the past 8 months of what was really, 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 really hard. And I mean, every day revolved around my illness. Every single day I had to flush the tube. I had to give myself, I think it was daily. I don't remember. Pretty sure it was daily Lovenox shots. I know maybe it was twice. I don't know. I think it was just once. I can't really remember. I know it was every day. So yeah, it was hard, but I'll take 8 months apart at any time. Like for being alive.
Right.
So, you know, for keeping my liver healthy, as best as I can. So yeah, it's been a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can recognize that in your face. And yeah. I see that in my own life. And I think COVID did a number on all of us, because it was like, are we even safe to go see a doctor? And hearing you talk about, like, you knew at your core that something was going on. That's the part that's hardest for me to reconcile, is that, like, I have all these fantastic doctors that take care of different parts of me, right? I have someone that works with my mental health, and I have many, many teams that work with all the different parts of my physical health. But I'm the only person at the end of the day who, like, knows myself and my voice and knows, like, something's not right. Or no, I'm good. Like, I know that the numbers don't look good, but I know that, like, things are fine. And this is like a little blip. And like, it's so challenging to be integrated with ourselves, and then to also weigh the opinions of experts in their field. But you're you, like, and I'm me, and we're the only ones that know, like, what Absolutely. We are on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I also think it's important to always know that, like, don't compare your journey to somebody else, right? Like, yeah, this weird thing happened to me, but you can't think that that, you know, will happen to you, type of thing.
Right.
Like, everybody, I have not heard one person's story that's the same.
No. I mean, we have overlaps, right? But
yeah.
I think at the core, it's like real. What I see the common thread being is, we're all realizing, like, chronic illness is not an end point, but we have to learn how to work with it in our own context and learn to listen to our body and to give ourselves grace and kindness, and then figure out, like, how to help other people and make an impact in whatever way we can while still taking care of ourselves.
Totally. And there were so many people that lifted me up during those past 8 months. Like, I can't imagine going through what I went through without the community, and without, like, I had seen a couple other women that had shared, like, their dream story in different capacities. And I had never seen before I had it what a biliary drain even looked like. Right. So I found that to be pretty helpful. And that's what kind of helped me get through that process, was knowing that I wasn't the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel really fortunate that I was able to, you know, come across so many different people that have, you know, really helped me in so many ways.
Yeah. The community is what we need.
I still do. Yeah. Every day, whether I'm posting every day or not.
Yes, absolutely. And you have, you know, people on speed dial. That's not even a thing anymore. People on your phone that you can call and say, like, totally. I'm having a hard day, and they can do the same for you. And, like, that's how we get through this messy life.
Absolutely.
You have a big event coming up with biliary atresia, and I want to give you opportunity to talk about that, because I think it's really cool.
Yeah. So I'm really excited to be involved with the biliary atresia. It's a mouthful. Research and education nonprofit. And they are having their first symposium in Chicago in May. And I'm really excited to meet a lot of people across the country that I haven't been able to meet before, and learn more about this, where we're at, because quite frankly, I don't know. That's the thing about a rare disease, right? The amount of attention and research and X, Y, and Z. This disease is very elusive. And I'm very excited to connect with people that have more information and just be a part of the conversation. Yeah. So.
Is it like medical professionals? Is it parents? Yeah. Is it all of the above?
Yeah. So there'll be a CME day. So some type of medical, I don't know what it stands for. CME is certified medical something. I don't know. I don't know.
I should ask my boyfriend. We don't have to know that part.
Yeah, I don't know because I am not a doctor.
Yay.
Yay. So there's that. And then there's a family and friends day. I'm so excited for that. So it's all going to be really wonderful.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. And I think that will give you more context for like what's going on and also just bring hope to a lot of parents. Like, can you imagine seeing an adult like yourself who's been through this and a parent going, oh my God, there's hope for my kid. Like, makes me want to cry a little bit. Because that's the only way sometimes we feel like we can survive is to see that like someone else has already done it.
Totally. I mean, the same point of somebody, you know, sharing about their drain situation. I mean, it really helped me just take it one day at a time.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to be very cool. And we may have to have a follow-up conversation once it's over. So you can share your learnings with us.
Yeah. And every time I talk about my story, I mean, I just feel a little bit more at ease and at peace. I mean, before I couldn't even say the word liver transplant without hyperventilating. So to be able to talk about this, you know, without having those ups and those downs and feel very at peace, that took me a lot of going through a lot of hard things to get at. And I wouldn't trade any of that, to be completely honest. Mm. Maybe some days.
I'm like, I don't know.
I don't know. Maybe some days. Good. That was pretty terrible, but yeah.
You know, and I don't think I realized, I mean, even though we've met, I don't think I realized like how much you didn't really talk about it before. And never. For you to show up at the transplant games in 2022.
My best friends did not even know until I was, you know, I was friends with people for X amount of years and close friends. They didn't even know I had a transplant.
Mm. And that's like a conversation a lot of people have, especially like young adults. They're like, when do I disclose when I have my transplant? How do I do this dating thing? Like,
you can't hide it.
I mean, it can't be top secret forever. But I think the core of it is you get to decide when you're comfortable and how much you share. There's not a right answer. But for me, knowing that I can talk about it, like you said, it gives me peace. I know that I can be like my whole self with people rather than like feeling like I have to watch what I say and do. That's really hard to manage long term.
even in business in my profession, I would never dare to speak to it. I mean, the CEO of the company that I work for had no idea, even when I was going through some of my illness. And then finally, I was just like, you know, the things that were going through her mind, she had no idea what was going on. And I had to take all this time off. And sharing it had gave me a lot of peace. Although like before I thought, you know, controlling it, this is me personally, you know, controlling it was the best way, not knowing was the best way. But as soon as I was able to tell and share, it helped me not be as worried. But everyone gets their choice. So that's the beauty of it.
It is. It really is. And I'm trying to figure out this whole, like how to be a chronically ill person in a world of business and like, let people know what accommodations I need when I need them, because I'm learning that people are a lot more kind than I give them credit for the most part. And, you know, we all deal with our stuff. And for me, it's like, I was scared because of just in general in the United States, our ableist culture. Of like, if we disclose this, we are less valuable or we're in danger of losing our job or like all the fears that were rolling around in my head. And I felt like I had something to prove by knowing myself that I had a lot going on, but not sharing that with other people. Like, oh, I can be just like everyone else. Now I know I'm definitely not like everyone else and I'm totally okay with that. but that's, again, a personal choice about like where people land and what career and what field they work in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I just want it to be more normalized. Like, I think we all have a lot more going on than we than we like to admit, every person on the planet. Well, do you have any closing thoughts that you would want to get, maybe advice you would give a young person, or something you've learned that's just like that you say to yourself every day? I don't know. Any food for thought for us?
I think the biggest thing that has personally helped me is doing CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. I don't recommend self-guided, but I got self-guided books. And it really has helped me a lot, just really not allowing intrusive thoughts to rule my world. Some days they do win, and that is okay.
Right.
But I do try to practice that, and it has helped me a lot. Yeah. Not just because of my transplant, but because of a lot of things. And I think it could benefit most people. So, I would say that is probably the thing that has helped me the most. And, I would say the second thing is just, and it's easier said than done, but just be you in whatever capacity, way, whatever that means. Just you only get one chance at this. So, and you know, whatever sparks your joy, whatever that is, for me, it's really trying to live out as authentically as possible. And, I don't know exactly what that means, but if that means going on a trip, if that means, whatever it is, try your best to honor that, because we're so lucky to, I really truly wake up and I do believe I'm so lucky to be here. Yeah. And I know, things could have been different, and they may be different in the future. So I'm very aware of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So those are two things.
Jenny, thank you so much.
It was so good talking to you. You're so easy to talk with.
I love any conversation I get to have with you, and keeping up with you on social media. And next time I'm in your area, we're going to go dancing or something fun.
For sure. Yeah. And I'll have to come visit too.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for listening today. We're always so glad you're here. If you enjoyed today's episode, please take a quick moment to subscribe, rate, and comment. Because we share good things with our friends, pass along this episode to someone you thought of today. As always, you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at The Bonus Years, and on our website, www.thebonusyearsblog.com.